The Chicago Public Schools originally were supposed to publicly outline the district-wide budget this past week, but CPS officials announced they will release the spending plan next month. What won't be in the document? The full impact of the next teachers union contract. How could that look? Well, we're going to ask the Chicago Teachers Union president. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. My guest this week is Chicago Teachers Union President Stacey Davis Gates. She was elected president of the union in 2002. She was vice president under Jesse Sharkey for 4 years before that. She really became the face of the union during the 2019 teachers strike. It is under Stacey Davis Gates that the CTU has grown stronger in political power and confidence, and of course, drawn even more ire of conservatives in this area. President Davis Gates, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about that CPS budget for a bit, because public school CEO Pedro Martinez says his administration wants to collaborate with CPS stakeholders and do further diligence since the budget model is new. Is that delay reasonable in your eyes? And how does the CTU feel about this new model?
Well, listen, I feel a few ways about this. Number one, we have pushed back and challenged student-based budgeting, the way in which Rahm Emanuel began to fund our school districts. We were on a constant refrain that the funding formula in Chicago had to look more equitable. It had to look more like the funding formula that was passed in, I think, 2017 for the state of Illinois, the evidence-based funding model. That funding model prioritizes the things that we need in our school communities: wraparound services, smaller class sizes, bilingual supports. The student-based budgeting deprioritized neighborhood schools, and quite frankly, it put schools that did not have an overabundance of students in their hallways at a disadvantage. It also deprivileged Black women significantly, because many of our Black women who are educators both have a master's degree, some have more than a master's degree, and so those are expensive teachers. So these were women who were without jobs if their schools closed or they were turned around. So the transition from student-based budgeting to the model that Chicago Public Schools has now is significant. And we are not clear yet about how significantly beneficial it is. I do think they are doing the right thing and slowing it down and showing their work, because they did not show their work before the budget was implemented, well, before the budget was sent to the school communities. There are a few issues with this. Number one, I don't think that the orientation to the budgeting process for principals was done in a very dimensional process. And so principals who were once using the budget in a particular way now have to relearn how to implement the budget. What we are experiencing are layoffs of Black women again. This time, they are not classroom teachers. There are teachers' assistants, our paraprofessionals, people who actually, if you ask me, they're the mortar to the bricks of the building. They hold everything together. And so we believe that anything that is equitable and just has to include space for support staff that live in the neighborhoods, who send their children to the schools where they work. And we have to figure that out. So it is a benefit to have some time to ask more thorough questions and to understand it. I hope that they're doing the same thing with their principals, quite frankly, because what we've gotten from our members is a lot of confusion, is a lot of variability across the district in how it is being implemented. So it is a good thing that we have time to ask more questions and to see if the impact that we're experiencing was intended, and if it was unintended, is there a fix for it? Because as it is relating now, our paraprofessionals need to be in the building. Our tech coordinators need to be in the building. We've seen quite a few of our homeless family coordinators be laid off at the same time where homelessness in this city is at an all-time high. Those two things also don't make sense. So getting time to inquire, interrogate, investigate, perhaps revise if necessary. I think that's the benefit of having a mayor who was a middle school teacher.
I can see, and that's going to come up a couple of times in this conversation, I think, being able to have someone from, with your perspective in there. And I would think evidence-based would suggest, as you said, it's what is needed in the classrooms. I would, just as in somebody from outside, would think that means they're going to better value the support staff, because it doesn't that shouldn't that be part of the evidence? And how is it not? And how are those people vanishing under this model?
Look, many of our parents are working parents, parents who have more than one job. And the people who connect most closely to those parents are the people who are standing outside of the school community when you drop your kid off. Those are our paraprofessionals. These are the people who answer the telephone when you call the school. These are our paraprofessionals. These are the people who families most intimately engage with. The paraprofessionals in the building understand the legacy of families in that community. They understand the legacy of policy and practice in the school communities. I don't know how you have school without them, quite frankly. And so we've been pushing very hard for a different type of review of this because our paraprofessionals, especially in our bilingual communities, are critical for making this work happen because you have many families who are immigrant families, newcomer families, who come into the school community and need someone instantly to communicate with. And in many of our Black schools where newcomers are enrolling, those people don't exist. So how are you laying off bilingual paraprofessionals when there are plenty of jobs for them in some of our Black elementary schools? Because many of our newcomers are being routed into those places because that's where vacancy exists within the neighborhoods.
And the CPS officials say they're facing a $400 million shortfall. Obviously, that's got to be behind some of the layoffs. But how can the system close a gap like that? Assuming that that it's a valid valid complaint. How do you close a gap like that without hurting the product, hurting the teachers and the staff that we're even talking about?
Well, listen, every summer, every spring, every winter before negotiations, you hear the boss talk about structural debt and what they don't have. So forgive me if my anxiety hasn't risen above level five, because this is a part of the collective bargaining process. So I do recognize that. I also recognize, though, that the Chicago Public Schools and its leadership is going to have to do better in Springfield. They're going to have a more intentional relationship with legislators. They're going to have a more intentional relationship about showing their work, where it has worked well, where they need more assistance, and how to get that support. A part of the work that we do here at the Teachers Union, it's pushing for as many of our elected officials to be engaged in what we need, how we see the world. So the discussions about revenue, the discussions about funding make sense to them. You can't make funding priorities make sense to people in May. They have to make sense well before May. And so in that case, I am very critical of the Chicago Public Schools because I do think that they need to have a better discussion about revenue and a better discussion about funding in Springfield and in Washington, D.C. We want a great community schools program here in Chicago. Are they maximizing enough of the dollars from D.C. in that respect? Are they maximizing enough dollars for facilities as it relates to DC and all of the green sustainability that they are putting forward and grants to school districts. So this exercise is a good exercise. And I think the reflection, well, I hope the reflection that all of the stakeholders have when it is over is that in order to transform the Chicago public schools, people have got to get better at the collaboration muscle. I know that we are stretching ours. We are stretching it. We are building it. We are working it. We're exhausted over here because right now, we would have already have done an action on CPS for what we need. Instead of doing an action, we are engaging them and understanding the budget, providing some ideas and some options for how we think we can move this ahead. And while we still reserve the right to be the union we are also building a muscle of curiosity, of trying to be a part of a solution from the beginning and not the end.
And let's talk about a little bit before we get into the nuts and bolts of the contract proposal. You initiated something that has happened by the time this is aired, but was about to happen. Let's talk a little bit about why you decided to do a public negotiation session where people could actually see how things go at the table.
Well, look, Karen Lewis in 2010 said that she wanted to do this. In fact, when Karen ran for leadership of this union on her slate, this was one of the priorities. So for the past 14 years, we have demanded, proposed with every single mayor, public bargaining. This is the first time that we've gotten it. We believe it is incumbent upon the district and our union to show our work. We want to show the good parts of our work. We want to show the parts of our work that deserve more funding and value. We want to show the disparities in which we deal with. The thing about the Chicago Public Schools is that it has never, ever been valued in the way that it should be valued. It takes in the greatest amount of our children throughout this city, and it has to be an anchor in the communities in which it resides. We have got to take responsibility and be accountable for the institution. I think opening bargaining up so families, so residents of this city understand what our proposals are, what our vision is for transformation, will be something transformative within itself. Additionally, they'll see us with community partners. They'll see us with students. We're not bargaining this contract, Stacey Davis Gates, Jackson Potter, Maria Moreno, Crystal Williams. We're bargaining this contract as a whole union with all of the people that we work with in coalition. And I think that open bargaining will be an opportunity for Chicago to see that demonstrated.
Well, and we will be following that along. The latest teacher union contract proposals that have been made public, those demands have, of course, drawn some fire from some conservatives for being too big, of course, but also including too many elements not directly concerned with education. And that's a philosophical change for the union over the last 2 years. What do you say to people who say, wait a minute, you're getting into stuff that you know shouldn't have anything to do with what's going on in the classroom?
Well, it's really interesting. And so I'll say two things. One, I'll take care of the conservative argument. Number one, conservatives don't even want Black children to be able to read. Remember, these same conservatives are the conservatives who probably would have been championing Black codes during Reconstruction or thereafter. So forgive me again, if conservatives pushing back on educating immigrant children, Black children, children who live in poverty, doesn't make my anxiety go up. That's what they're supposed to say. That is literally a part of the oath that they take to be right wing. That being said, we look at the collective bargaining process as our down payment in the investment of the future of our young people in the city of Chicago. As you know, our members have to live in the city of Chicago. And I think it's a wonderful part about our relationship to the city. If we can work here, if we can benefit from the city, then we can also be a neighbor to the people that we serve and the people who need our labor. We can push together in the same direction. And not so ironically, that's where our common good bargaining principles originate. We live in the neighborhoods. I am a Southsider. I know what it means to figure out how to go to a store in someone else's community because the stores in my community don't have something. I understand what it means to live across the street from a vacant space that used to have a house there and a family there. These are things that not only concern us with respect to the children who come into our school communities, but they also concern us as investors in the future in the ecosystem of Chicago. So when we talk about common good bargaining, what we're talking about is that our members are investing in this city. It does mean something when there are 20,000 classified unhoused young people in the city, because it means a lack of stability for our city. That's why we are going to put forward proposals that will compel the CHA to move those families to the top of the list and have a timeline to put them in homes. If you are a student and you get homework, how do you complete homework if you don't have a home? And so these are fundamental. Look, the type of structures that exist in places where people are valued don't always exist in the neighborhoods where our members both work and live. They are committed to creating a better space to leave for the future. And that's why they leverage the collective bargaining process to fight for housing, to fight for green, sustainable school communities, to fight against the pollution and the decay in many of our communities.
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm Craig Dellamore at City Hall, and my guest is Stacey Davis Gates, president of the Chicago Teachers Union. Talk a little bit about the green school initiatives. I think people, when they hear housing for students, that they can kind of understand why that argument works. Why get involved with green schools?
Well, why not would be the question. Like all of what we're bargaining for in terms of our future is null and void if our earth is on fire. And so again, we have to take some responsibility for the parts of this that do belong to us. So for instance, you have Washington High School and Washington Elementary School on the southeast side of the city. And about a year ago, the roof or excuse me, the ceiling started to collapse during passing period. This is a building that was prefabricated, was always meant to be a temporary school so they could build the school. And that never happened. And so what we are bargaining is how do we sequence this? And once they get approval for a new building, how are we making sure that the building is sustainable? That it actually provides a benefit to the community and the way in which it is built. Here's another part to this. A CTE program, a career technology education program that also would prepare our young people to build these types of buildings. So it's a both and. How do we create CTE programming that equips our young people to be competitive in the green economy? And then how can they also be a part of manifesting that green economy and the neighborhoods in which they live? So it's a both and, a facility? Sure. Who builds the facility? Who helps design the facility? Our students. So how do we create platform and space for our own sustainability, as a city, as a neighborhood, as a school district? That is embedded in how we are encountering our contract proposals.
What are the union's concerns about test scores and teacher evaluations? I think people see that come up as an issue, but I'm not sure the public generally realizes what the real issues are.
Well, here's the thing about teacher evaluation that always makes me chuckle. Our educators evaluate for a living. And so when you create an evaluation system that doesn't make sense to those who do evaluation, that's where the push and pull happens, right? So you have professionals who are embedded in the practice and the sequence and the process of evaluation. And when they see an evaluation tool created that fails to have the components that provides the actual individual being evaluated, both with the reflection, the support, and the agility to get better, then that becomes the problem. Right now, we have a program that we do with CPS. It's called the National Board. Well, it's called, what is it called? Nurturing Teacher Leadership. That's what the program is called. At the end of the program, our educators will become nationally board certified teachers. It is a very intense evaluation process. They do all sorts of lessons, they practice methodologies, but the intensity of the evaluation and the reflection, and then the agility and their methods happen in such concentration and truncated amount of times. It actually produces the thing that we need to see in our school communities. What we've gotten traditionally from the state and from the school district is something completely different. So our educators that we train with the Chicago Public Schools go through something that I would submit is more intense, but way more valuable. That's not even what they want to negotiate. They want to negotiate something that's, I think, smaller, something that doesn't provide the results that we need. The current evaluation system we have, what it does is that it gives demerits to teachers who teach in Black communities that are low income. The University of Chicago School Research Center published, I think, about a couple of years ago, a study that showed that teachers, Black or white, Black, white or brown, male or female, who work in communities that have been disinvested in, typically have poorer evaluations. Now that's a double one. That is a double whammy for Black women who do that. So you can't possibly tell me that that is a fair evaluation system when the study of that system doesn't privilege and, in fact, deprivileges communities of colors, both the students and the educators. So what we want to do is take the disparity out of the evaluation system and provide something that is perhaps more dimensional, involved, and reflective of actual practice. It is a system where our nationally board certified teachers, it's a system in which, excuse me, it's a process in which they submit to, and they are like the master teachers in their school community. That's something that our members would like to see more than the tool that is currently used.
So how should the schools hold someone, and you tell me who, accountable if students or schools are underperforming? Is there any measure that can really handle that? Is it about accountability or is it about resources?
Well, I think my members will tell you is that accountability happens every day in the school community. I can certainly tell you that that accountability happens every day. I will also tell you that if because you're in school communities, you are always perfecting your practice. Accountability doesn't just happen with the test score. These are actual human beings in front of our educators. The accountability is staring at you every single day. Now, how do we get to having children that are being given an education that they deserve and then making good on that particular input? That's the question. And so, what I would submit is that you have to have more than a test. Young people don't come to school to take standardized tests. In fact, our school communities are really the social centers for young people. What happens in school communities that are doing it right, they have everything else. They have band, they have orchestra, they have choir, they have baseball, they have track, they have soccer, they have basketball, they have volleyball, they have newspaper, they have yearbook, they have activities that draw young people in to a process of practicing, of perfecting, of performing, of producing. And that is what's missing from our classrooms. Test scores aren't missing. Teacher evaluation isn't missing. All of these things were sold to us from people like Arne Duncan, from people like Rahm Emanuel, as the panacea, the thing that would make it happen. Well, what I would submit to you is that it still hasn't happened. What happens in places that have good, sustainable, and stable achievement is that they have tremendous investment in the school community and the surrounding community.
There are so many other things I want to ask you, but the very last thing is, you know, that the theme, the public theme of the coming negotiations and the negotiations underway is that the union is the power behind Brandon Johnson, and that this is like sitting down and negotiating with yourself. How do you prove or make people understand if you know that that's not the case?
Well, I would have to accept that that was the case to begin with. So, to be, perfectly transparent, that's not a critique that's even legitimate to me. The Chicago Public Schools has been an institution for generations in this city. There's no amount of relationship that is going to help transform a system that has never had the investment that it deserves. I'm a high school history teacher. And I know that the creation of the Chicago Public Schools and then the stewardship of the Chicago Public Schools, the intention was to make sure that the titans of industry in the city had a worker class, not an intelligentsia class, not an activist class, but a worker class. And so what I am saying is that a relationship only gets you to the point of saying hi and bye in a collegial manner. What we are going to need are tremendous resources. We're going to need very strict timelines. We're going to need principals, teachers, paraprofessionals, clinicians working in the same direction with the district and with city leadership to make this happen. The relationship enables all of the hard work. The relationships in the past were hurdles and impediments to the hard work. So what we have now is a clearer path to do the hard work.
Stacey Davis Gates, thank you so much. We are out of time, and there, like I said, there's so much more we want to talk to you
Well,
about.
have me back.
I
I'll be glad to
absolutely,
come.
absolutely. That is Stacey Davis Gates, president of the Chicago Teachers Union. To our listeners, if you would like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website, WBBMNewsRadio.com. There's a link on the homepage, and you can also find our podcasts on Odyssey.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Delamore, News Radio 1059 WBBM. The Chicago Public Schools originally were supposed to publicly outline the district-wide budget this past week, but CPS officials announced they will release the spending plan next month. What won't be in the document? The full impact of the next teachers' union contract. How could that look? Well, we're going to ask the Chicago Teachers Union president. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. We'll be right back. My guest this week is Chicago Teachers Union President Stacey Davis Gates. She was elected president of the union in 2002. She was vice president under Jesse Sharkey for 4 years before that. She really became the face of the union during the 2019 teachers strike. It is under Stacey Davis Gates that the CTU has grown stronger in political power and confidence, and of course, drawn even more ire of conservatives in this area. President Davis Gates, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about a little bit about that CPS budget for a bit, because public school CEO Pedro Martinez says his administration wants to collaborate with CPS stakeholders and do further diligence since the budget model is new. Is that delay reasonable in your eyes, and how does the CTU feel about this new model?
Well, listen, I feel a few ways about this. Number one, we have pushed back and challenged student-based budgeting, the way in which Rahm Emanuel began to fund our school districts. We were on a constant refrain that the funding formula in Chicago had to look more equitable. It had to look more like the funding formula that was passed in, I think, 2017 for the state of Illinois, the evidence-based funding model. That funding model prioritizes the things that we need in our school communities: wraparound services, smaller class sizes, bilingual supports. The student-based budgeting deprioritized neighborhood schools. And quite frankly, it put schools that did not have an overabundance of students in their hallways at a disadvantage. It also deprivileged Black women significantly, because many of our Black women who are educators both have a master's degree. Some have more than a master's degree, and so those are expensive teachers. So these were women who were without jobs if their schools closed or they were turned around. So the transition from student-based budgeting to the model that Chicago Public Schools has now is significant. And we are not clear yet about how significantly beneficial it is. I do think they are doing the right thing and slowing it down and showing their work, because they did not show their work before the budget was implemented. Well, before the budget was sent to the school communities. There are a few issues with this. Number one, I don't think that the orientation to the budgeting process for principals was done in a very dimensional process. And so principals who were once using the budget in a particular way now have to relearn how to implement the budget. What we are experiencing are layoffs of Black women again. This time, they are not classroom teachers. There are teachers' assistants, our paraprofessionals, people who actually, if you ask me, they're the mortar to the bricks of the building. They hold everything together. And so we believe that anything that is equitable and just has to include space for support staff that live in the neighborhoods, who send their children to the schools where they work. And we have to figure that out. So it is a benefit to have some time to ask more thorough questions and to understand it. I hope that they're doing the same thing with their principals, quite frankly, because what we've gotten from our members is a lot of confusion, is a lot of variability across the district in how it is being implemented. So it is a good thing that we have time to ask more questions and to see if the impact that we're experiencing was intended, and if it was unintended, is there a fix for it? Because as it is relating now, our paraprofessionals need to be in the building, our tech coordinators need to be in the building. We've seen quite a few of our homeless family coordinators be laid off at the same time where homelessness in this city is at an all-time high. Those two things also don't make sense. So getting time to inquire, interrogate, investigate, perhaps revise if necessary, I think that's the benefit of having a mayor who was a middle school teacher.
I can see, and that's going to come up a couple of times in this conversation, I think, being able to have someone with your perspective in there. And I would think evidence-based would suggest, as you said, it's what is needed in the classrooms. I would, just as in somebody from outside, would think that means they're going to better value the support staff. Because it doesn't that shouldn't that be part of the evidence? And how is it not? And how are those people vanishing under this model?
Look, many of our parents are working parents, parents who have more than one job. And the people who connect most closely to those parents are the people who are standing outside of the school community when you drop your kid off. Those are our paraprofessionals. These are the people who answer the telephone when you call the school. These are our paraprofessionals. These are the people who families most intimately engage with. The paraprofessionals in the building understand the legacy of families in that community. They understand the legacy of policy and practice in the school communities. I don't know how you have school without them, quite frankly. And so we've been pushing very hard for a different type of review of this, because our paraprofessionals, especially in our bilingual communities, are critical for making this work happen, because you have many families who are immigrant families, newcomer families, who come into the school community and need someone instantly to communicate with. And in many of our Black schools where newcomers are enrolling, those people don't exist. So how are you laying off bilingual paraprofessionals when there are plenty of jobs for them in some of our Black elementary schools, because many of our newcomers are being routed into those places because that's where vacancy exists within the neighborhoods?
And, you know, the CPS officials say they're facing a $400 million shortfall. Obviously, that's got to be behind some of the layoffs. But how can the system close a gap like that? Assuming that it, you know, that it's a valid valid complaint, how do you close a gap like that without hurting the product, hurting the teachers and the staff that we're even talking about?
Well, listen, every summer, every spring, every winter before negotiations, you hear the boss talk about structural debt and what they don't have. So forgive me if my anxiety hasn't risen above level five, because this is a part of the collective bargaining process. So I do recognize that. I also recognize, though, that the Chicago Public Schools and its leadership is going to have to do better in Springfield. They're going to have a more intentional relationship with legislators. They're going to have a more intentional relationship about showing their work, where it has worked well, where they need more assistance, and how to get that support. A part of the work that we do here at the teachers union is pushing for as many of our elected officials to be engaged in what we need, how we see the world. So the discussions about revenue, the discussions about funding make sense to them. You can't make funding priorities make sense to people in May. They have to make sense well before May. And so in that case, I am very critical of the Chicago Public Schools, because I do think that they need to have a better discussion about revenue and a better discussion about funding in Springfield and in Washington, D.C. We want a great community schools program here in Chicago. Are they maximizing enough of the dollars from D.C. in that respect? Are they maximizing enough dollars for facilities as it relates to DC and all of the green sustainability that they are putting forward in grants to school districts? So this exercise is a good exercise. And I think the reflection, well, I hope the reflection that all of the stakeholders have when it is over is that in order to transform the Chicago Public Schools, people have got to get better at the collaboration muscle. I know that we are stretching ours. We are stretching it. We are building it. We are working it. We're exhausted over here, because right now, we would have already have done an action on CPS for what we need. Instead of doing an action, we are engaging them and understanding the budget, providing some ideas and some options for how we think we can move this ahead. And while we still reserve the right to be the union we are also building a muscle of curiosity, of trying to be a part of a solution from the beginning and not the end.
And let's talk about a little bit before we get into the nuts and bolts of the contract proposal. You initiated something that has happened by the time this is aired, but was about to happen. Let's talk a little bit about why you decided to do a public negotiation session. Where people could actually see how things go at the table.
Well, look, Karen Lewis in 2010 said that she wanted to do this. In fact, when Karen ran for leadership of this union on her slate, this was one of the priorities. So for the past 14 years, we have demanded, proposed with every single mayor, public bargaining. This is the first time that we've gotten it. We believe it is incumbent upon the district and our union to show our work. We want to show the good parts of our work. We want to show the parts of our work that deserve more funding and value. We want to show the disparities in which we deal with. The thing about the Chicago Public Schools is that it has never, ever been valued in the way that it should be valued. It takes in the greatest amount of our children throughout this city, and it has to be an anchor in the communities in which it resides. We have got to take responsibility and be accountable for the institution. I think opening bargaining up so families, so residents of this city understand what our proposals are, what our vision is for transformation, will be something transformative within itself. Additionally, they'll see us with community partners. They'll see us with students. We're not bargaining this contract, Stacey Davis Gates, Jackson Potter, Maria Moreno, Crystal Williams. We're bargaining this contract as a whole union with all of the people that we work with in coalition. And I think that open bargaining will be an opportunity for Chicago to see that demonstrated.
Well, and we will be following that along. The latest teacher union contract proposals that have been made public, those demands have, of course, drawn some fire from some conservatives for being too big, of course, but also including too many elements not directly concerned with education. And that's a philosophical change for the union over the last 2 years. What do you say to people who say, wait a minute, you're getting into stuff that you know shouldn't have anything to do with what's going on in the classroom?
Well, it's really interesting. And so I'll say two things. One, I'll take care of the conservative argument. Number one, conservatives don't even want Black children to be able to read. Remember, these same conservatives are the conservatives who probably would have been championing Black codes, during Reconstruction or thereafter. So forgive me again if conservatives pushing back on educating immigrant children, Black children, children who live in poverty, doesn't make my anxiety go up. That's what they're supposed to say. That is literally a part of the oath that they take to be right wing. That being said, we look at the collective bargaining process as our down payment in the investment of the future of our young people in the city of Chicago. As you know, our members have to live in the city of Chicago. And I think it's a wonderful part about our relationship to the city. If we can work here, if we can benefit from the city, then we can also be a neighbor to the people that we serve and the people who need our labor. We can push together in the same direction. And not so ironically, that's where our common good bargaining principles originate. We live in the neighborhoods. I am a Southsider. I know what it means to Figure out how to go to a store in someone else's community because the stores in my community don't have something. I understand what it means to live across the street from a vacant space that used to have a house there and a family there. These are things that not only concern us with respect to the children who come into our school communities, but they also concern us as investors in the future in the ecosystem of Chicago. So when we talk about common good bargaining, what we're talking about is that our members are investing in this city. It does mean something when there are 20,000 classified unhoused young people in the city, because it means a lack of stability for our city. That's why we are going to put forward proposals that will compel the CHA to move those families to the top of the list and have a timeline to put them in homes. If you are a student and you get homework, how do you complete homework if you don't have a home? And so these are fundamental. Look, the type of structures that exist in places where people are valued don't always exist in the neighborhoods where our members both work and live. They are committed to creating a better space to leave for the future. And that's why they leverage the collective bargaining process to fight for housing, to fight for green, sustainable school communities, to fight against the pollution and the decay in many of our communities.
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm Craig Dellamore at City Hall, and my guest is Stacey Davis-Gates, president of the Chicago Teachers Union. Talk a little bit about the green schools initiatives. I think people, when they hear housing for students, that they can kind of understand why that argument works. Why get involved with green schools?
Well, why not would be the question. Like all of what we're bargaining for in terms of our future is null and void if our earth is on fire. And so again, we have to take some responsibility for the parts of this that do belong to us. So for instance, you have Washington High School and Washington Elementary School on the southeast side of the city. And about a year ago, the roof or excuse me, the ceiling started to collapse during passing period. This is a building that was prefabricated, was always meant to be a temporary school so they could build the school. And that never happened. And so what we are bargaining is how do we sequence this? And once they get approval for a new building, how are we making sure that the building is sustainable? That it actually provides a benefit to the community and the way in which it is built. Here's another part to this. A CTE program, a career technology education program that also would prepare our young people to build these types of buildings. So it's a both and. How do we create CTE programming that equips our young people to be competitive in the green economy? And then how can they also be a part of manifesting that green economy and the neighborhoods in which they live? So it's a both and. A facility? Sure. Who builds the facility? Who helps design the facility? Our students. So how do we create platform and space for our own sustainability as a city, as a neighborhood, as a school district? That is embedded in how we are encountering our contract proposals.
What are the union's concerns about test scores and teacher evaluations? I think people see that come up as an issue, but I'm not sure the public generally realizes what the real issues are.
Well, here's the thing about teacher evaluation that always makes me chuckle. Our educators evaluate for a living. And so when you create an evaluation system that doesn't make sense to those who do evaluation, that's where the push and pull happens, right? So you have professionals who are embedded in the practice and the sequence and the process of evaluation. And when they see an evaluation tool created that fails to have the components that provides the actual individual being evaluated, both with the reflection, the support, and the agility to get better, then that becomes the problem. Right now, we have a program that we do with CPS. It's called the National Board. Well, it's called, what is it called? Nurturing Teacher Leadership. That's what the program is called. At the end of the program, our educators will become nationally board certified teachers. It is a very intense evaluation process. They do all sorts of lessons, they practice methodologies, but the intensity of the evaluation and the reflection and then the agility and their methods happen in such concentration and truncated amount of times. It actually produces the thing that we need to see in our school communities. What we've gotten traditionally from the state and from the school district is something completely different. So our educators that we train with the Chicago Public Schools go through something that I would submit is more intense, but way more valuable. That's not even what they want to negotiate. They want to negotiate something that's, I think, smaller, something that doesn't provide the results that we need. The current evaluation system we have, what it does is that it gives demerits to teachers who teach in Black communities that are low income. The University of Chicago School Research Center published, I think about a couple of years ago, a study that showed that teachers, Black or white, Black, white or brown, male or female, who work in communities that have been disinvested in, typically have poorer evaluations. Now that's a double one. That is a double whammy for Black women who do that. So you can't possibly tell me that that is a fair evaluation system when the study of that system doesn't privilege and in fact deprivileges communities of colors, both the students and the educators. So what we want to do is take the disparity out of the evaluation system and provide something that is perhaps more dimensional, involved, and reflective of actual practice. It is a system where our nationally board certified teachers, it's a system in which, excuse me, it's a process in which they submit to, and they are like the master teachers in their school community. That's something that our members would like to see more than the tool that is currently used.
So, How should the schools hold someone, and you tell me who, accountable if students or schools are underperforming? Is there any measure that can really handle that? Is it about accountability or is it about resources?
Well, I think my members will tell you is that accountability happens every day in the school community. I can certainly tell you that that accountability happens every day. I will also tell you that if, because you're in school communities, you are always perfecting your practice. Accountability doesn't just happen with the test score. These are actual human beings in front of our educators. The accountability is staring at you every single day. Now, how do we get to having children that are being given an education that they deserve and then making good on that particular input? That's the question. And so what I would submit is that you have to have more than a test. Young people don't come to school to take standardized tests. In fact, our school communities are really the social centers for young people. What happens in school communities that are doing it right, they have everything else. They have band, they have orchestra, they have choir, they have baseball, they have track, they have soccer, they have basketball, they have volleyball, they have newspaper, they have yearbook, they have activities that draw young people in to a process of practicing, of perfecting, of performing, of producing. And that is what's missing from our classrooms. Test scores aren't missing. Teacher evaluation isn't missing. All of these things were sold to us from people like Arne Duncan, from people like Rahm Emanuel, as the panacea, the thing that would make it happen. Well, what I would submit to you is that it still hasn't happened. What happens in places that have good, sustainable, and stable achievement is that they have tremendous investment in the school community and the surrounding community.
There's so many other things I want to ask you, but the very last thing is, you know, that the theme, the public theme of the coming negotiations and the negotiations underway is that the union is the power behind Brandon Johnson, and that this is like sitting down and negotiating with yourself. How do you prove or make people understand, if you know, that that's not the case?
Well, I would have to accept that that was the case to begin with. So to be, you know, perfectly transparent, that's not a critique that's even legitimate to me. The Chicago Public Schools has been an institution for generations in this city. There's no amount of relationship that is going to help transform a system that has never had the investment that it deserves. I'm a high school history teacher, and I know that the creation of the Chicago Public Schools and then the stewardship of the Chicago Public Schools, the intention was to make sure that the titans of industry in the city had a worker class, not an intelligentsia class, not an activist class, but a worker class. And so what I am saying is that a relationship only gets you to the point of saying hi and bye in a collegial manner. What we are going to need are tremendous resources. We're going to need very strict timelines. We're going to need principals, teachers, paraprofessionals, clinicians working in the same direction with the district and with city leadership to make this happen. The relationship enables all of the hard work. The relationships in the past were hurdles and impediments to the hard work. So what we have now is a clearer path to do the hard work.
Stacey Davis Gates, thank you so much. We are out of time. And then, like I said, there's so much more we want to talk to you about.
Well, have me back.
Absolutely. That is Stacey Davis Gates, president of the Chicago Teachers Union. To our listeners, if you would like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website, WBBMNewsRadio.com. There's a link on the homepage, and you can also find our podcasts on Odyssey.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Delamore, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.